This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
John Whitehead is the CEO and the founder of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org. He joins me live in studio. Good afternoon, sir.
How are you doing? Very fine, thank you.
How you doing? You good? You having a good summer? Y'all are busy in the summer, aren't you?
7 days a week.
Yeah.
Very tired, burning the candle at both ends. Got 22 students studying with us this summer, and we've had 27 speakers come in.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
That's terrific.
Constitutional experts, people from around the country, and they all donate their time and come in, speak to the students, answer questions, and then the students do assignments, and we're teaching them the Bill of Rights. And our slogan is "Speak Truth to Power," and we have a bumper sticker like that. I know some of the students have actually pasted the bumper sticker up on there, right above their workstation, and most of them are from the University of Virginia this year.
Good.
It's like 13 students out of 22 are from the University of Virginia.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
it's a great opportunity.
It's good, and they have a lot of access to me and the rest of the staff, a lot of good discussions. We eat together once or twice a week, usually, a pizza, and sit around and talk, and great spirited discussions. And the intern program is designed to turn people into essentially what I would call street fighters. Get out there and defend the protesters, defend the Bill of Rights, picket if need be. I'm all for all. I like the radical stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So. And speaking of the Bill of Rights, you have the Rutherford Institute has a new guide to the Bill of Rights called "Do You Know the Bill of Rights?" And what am I looking at here?
Well, it's a nifty little guide. It's in semi-cartoon form, and people will enjoy it. It's states the amendment, and then states historically essentially what it means, and then we often raise questions about some of the amendments, how they're being interpreted today. But it's a very brief look. We're sending it to high schools across the country and passing it out free to virtually everybody, and I brought some copies along tonight, but it's easy to read. I mean, for young kids, 7th, 8th grade, I think they can sit down and read this and get the idea of what it's about. I think parents should take this pamphlet and read it to their kids in the home.
Now, your book is coming out in, September?
September 9th, I do believe, yes.
That's great. And it's called "The Change Manifesto, Join the Block by Block Movement to Remake America" by John Whitehead. And it is available now for pre-order online, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. So what can folks expect in this?
Well, so far, we sent out the manuscript to various people across the country. Nadine Strossen, who is president of the National ACLU, has heartily endorsed it. We've had Bruce Fine, former Attorney General, and Ronald Reagan endorse it. Even Pete Seeger, the legendary folk singer.
Oh, sure.
He loved it. Yeah. He's endorsed it. We got 10 really sterling endorsements from people. Conservatives and liberals and across the board have endorsed the book. It's 10 chapters. It's 300 and I got it right here in my hand. About 340 pages long. It's talks about all the what's happened to our civil liberties and our constitutional rights over the, especially the last 20-25 years, but it goes back a little deeper than that and talks about the fact that all the power is being focused in the executive now, and our Congress is absolutely awful. And I call for change in the book. I go show you how the police power has really developed across the country, how surveillance and security is going completely nuts, and I think we're moving into clearly a surveillance police state. And how can we stop all that? I talk about how families are being destroyed in some schools. So it covers a lot of different issues. I talk about the rising military empire and how that really will threaten democracy in the country. The last three chapters of the book are about hope. I have a little manifesto on the Bill of Rights. You can read it. It's about 20 pages long. And it can tell you everything you need to know about the Bill of Rights and the writ of habeas corpus. And I give a very radical read on the history of the Bill of Rights, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison. These people were really radical. In fact, I've said often, Jefferson, who said we needed a revolution every 20 years, if he said that today, he'd be under vest. They'd be tapping his phone. And he might even be in jail somewhere without a lawyer under the U.S. Patriot Act. So the people who started this country were radicals. They were firebrands. They grabbed their rifles. They fought the British. They stood against the greatest empire on the face of the earth at the time. We're not doing that today. But I do think the importance of the book, besides of all that, it's heavily footnoted. That's what my publisher in New York, Source Books, my editor, when he read the book, he called me. I said, "What do you think?" He said, "It's frightening." But he says, "You've documented everything." But I do think there's hope. There's hope in, you know, people just standing up and fighting back. I have hope throughout the book. It's individual citizens who go out and just give you an example. Lady who's protesting the Iraq war 3 or 4 years ago in Denver went out on the street corner dressed in black. She was copying some Israeli women who had done it over in Israel and held up a sign that she would protest the Iraq war. People drive by were honking, flipping the bird and stuff like that. Today, there's 30 or 40 women standing out there with her, and the groups around the country have started doing that. And so whether you're for the war or not, it's not important. But what's important is she went out there and stood on the street corner and did what the founding fathers did and the founding mothers. So there's all kinds of stories like that in the book. There are people who are making a difference. It's not Congress. You can't bet on the Congress to do it. You can't bet on the president to do it or the courts. You have to go out and do it. And so the book gives you a step-by-step way. I have 11 steps in the book in Chapter 8. It's the hope chapter. Be creative. Things you can actually do, go out and stir up trouble. Maybe get arrested and then call the Rutherford Institute.
We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org.
But let me say this, the hour is very late, ladies and gentlemen. The economy is saying a lot of bad things. Usually rights are lost during bad economic times. So
And war. And now we got those combined. We
have perpetual war and the surveillance systems. Everything we see happening around us, government officials are angry. I see that. Something's happening in the country. So I think, a lot of the leaders I know in Washington are very pessimistic. Very, very pessimistic. They don't think much can happen now. I'm not of that mind, but it will take turning the television set off, the American Idol, whatever you happen to be watching, go to your local zoning meeting, your local planning meeting, fight for the homeless in the community. I mean, we've been helping some of the homeless groups work with the city here, fighting just to keep them open. So there are good people doing good things, but we're groups like us, the ACLU and other good groups are there to back you up, but you have to take it. We forget. The Constitution starts with those three beautiful words, "We the people." It's the people that have to do it. And if we don't do it, if we don't get up off our butts and do it, it's not going to happen. And that's what this book's all about, the Change Manifesto.
Change Manifesto, available now online for pre-order at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. We're talking with author John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. You spoke of the economy and the dangers posed to freedom in bad economic times. And you wrote an essay recently about that very subject. What was the title of it? The High Gas Prices, It's Time for a Revolution. What was that about?
Well, I looked at the gas thing, I was like, gee, what is the answer to this? I mean, gas over $4 a gallon. People in Hawaii paying $8 for a jar of peanut butter. It's affecting everything. And there are a number of reasons, obviously, for the gas. There's the Federal Reserve. People blame the Federal Reserve. The dollar is just worthless in various parts of the area. Obviously, that's driving the price up. Part of it, I think, has to be laid, as I say in this commentary, on the back of the major oil companies. All the five major oil companies are located in the United States. They made $123 billion last year in profits, and they get $40 billion plus in tax breaks from the government, from us subsidizing the drilling, and they still own it after we've paid for it, so they get sort of a double profit.
Yeah, we socialize all the investment and the risk, and we privatize the profit.
So what's what? You know, Congress supposedly called the big fellows in and investigated them a month or two ago, and they walked out, and that was it. But as a number of people say, follow the money. And since 1990, the oil and gas industries have contributed more than $200 million to Congress, to Republicans and Democrats in Congress, and it's no happen chance that the four top recipients of gas and oil money are all from Texas, congressmen from Texas. So yeah. I think Congress has let us down. I have a good friend in Congress who's a top aide to one of the to a senator in Congress, and we were talking not long ago, and he said, "John, we can't get him to pass a bill." It's totally broken down in Congress, but I think it's corruption. He also told me, he said, the thing that shocks me about these guys, he says, He said, I didn't know what they were talking about at first, but he said a few senators came up and said, I have to do my call time now. He didn't know what they were talking about. So he later found out these guys spent a couple afternoons a week calling all their lobbyist friends and donors to keep the money coming into them. That's on our buck, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
They're continually raising money. They're not doing their job. A lot of them don't show up to vote. So, again, our representatives aren't doing it. So what's the solution? There are a number of solutions, but the chief ones, throw the bums out. And, you know, we have two fellows running for president right now out of that same Congress that didn't do that much when they were there. So I think we have a tremendous leadership void. And is the economy going to get worse? Obviously. I mean, banks are going down. People are still losing their homes. The dollars.
Yeah.
80% of the goods we buy in this country come from China. We're not manufacturing anymore.
Now, John, there's somebody listening thinking, well, what are you, against capitalism? You're against oil companies making money? And I know you're not.
No.
But I think even those people that think that are ignorant of the fact that our government throws money you can only call it welfare. I mean, we throw this corporate welfare.
We subsidize it.
Yeah, we throw money at these corporations that are making billions in profits already.
Yep,
and we're giving them billions more. Here, take this,
and then we pay that much to the gas pump. There are a number of alternatives. I thought my column one is we need to fight them. It's obviously a monopoly going on. Congress used to fight those kind of things. Some people have talked about nationalizing the industry. I don't really actually believe that we should totally nationalize it. But why can't the government start its own oil company and compete? And bring the oil price down. That's some countries have done that, and they're paying less than a dollar a gas. There's a lot of things you can do. I'm not an expert on the area. I just look at it and say, why aren't we pursuing these things? Why isn't our Congress climbing down these people's back? Remember, when I see the interviews on television and talk to people, they're angry. When I see our congressmen, they're driving away in the limousine going to a dinner with somebody.
Yeah. Well, then Phil Graham, the advisor to John McCain's campaign, said, "Oh, this whole economic mess is just in your head."
Yes.
It's not really a mess at all. You're just imagining.
Tell it to someone who lost their home or losing their home across the country, yeah.
We're talking with John Whitehead, the CEO and the founder of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org.
One thing I think most people realize, they call Congress the Millionaires Club. There's over 100 multimillionaires in Congress. They get free haircuts, free flowers. They're chauffeured back and forth in limousines.
Great socialized medicine.
but here's the point. A leading commentator out of D.C. that I talk to often, who writes a national column, said they're totally out of touch with the American taxpayer. These are rich people. It doesn't say – I don't think rich people are evil. Some rich people have done great things in the past. But we have sort of a perk system set up, and these people have no idea what it means to have to fill up a gas tank. I doubt most of them – know how to turn a key in to get in the door. They probably got someone doing that. If you remember, and I wasn't against Kerry, but Kerry had a chef that followed him around and made peanut butter sandwiches when he ran for president.
I didn't know that. Are you serious?
People, we can't do that kind of thing. I mean, I have to make my own. I have to pour my own cereal in the bowl, okay, in the morning, cut my own fruit. So that's what as someone said to me recently, John, we've lost touch. The American people have lost control of their government. We've lost control of it. How do you take it back? Well, that's one reason I wrote my book, The Change Manifesto. There's a lot of things, but it's going to be – what I say is act locally, think nationally. You got to fight it here, you know, fight the gas problem here, fight people that are losing their homes here. There's a lot of things you can do, but most people sit back and think some congressman is going to protect their rights. Folks, that's not going to happen.
John Whitehead is our guest, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. If you've got a comment or question, you want to join this conversation, we invite you to do so, 977-1070. What are your thoughts about all these we're talking about the economy here, the banks failing, and I guess one thing I just want to point out, it's a good thing that we have this this big government Roosevelt-era scheme, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, which is there to bail out these failing banks so that people don't lose all their money. But that's a big government scheme. But, you know, there's everybody out there saying, oh, if we could just get the government out of this business. And, well, if the government was out of the business and we didn't have that, these banks would be failing and people would be losing their homes left and right.
Well, I had a banker tell me recently that there's a certain amount of money that is insured, but it will go really fast. It will go fast. All that money insured, and it's only up to $100,000
per person per bank. Yeah,
yeah. You will It'll wipe out the middle class. The middle class is already under amazing tension. We're developing two classes in this country. Generally, it's us and them. And the them is less than 1%. And there's that 99% of us still, all the working class poor in this country, people just barely getting by. So, I don't think that's a protection if it gets any further. We are in a recession. I don't know why people don't use that word. This is obviously a recession. Is it going to get worse? And well-reasoned people I know that are not alarmists think it's going to get worse, yes. And people are starting to, and here's the word, the Hoover word's coming up more. I'm reading it in news articles.
Yeah,
they're saying
Bush is the
worst president since Hoover. What are they saying,
And, of course, for folks who don't know, Herbert Hoover was the president during the 1920s and was manning the station when the banks failed and ushered in
the
Great
Depression.
And a lot of folks historically look towards Hoover as a president who was just not paying attention and looking the other way and doing everything wrong.
And rightly so. Congress has a 13% approval rating right now, one of the lowest in the history of Congress, and President Bush has a low approval rating, and Cheney's is 18%, I think.
Is it that low? Oh, my gosh.
So when you lose confidence in government, what does that say?
We're talking with John Whitehead. The phone lines are open, 977-1070. Susan is on line one. Susan, you're on with John. You go right ahead.
Hey, it's my understanding at least part of this housing crunch was caused because back years ago, several years ago, people were complaining that poorer people were being not allowed to get housing and so forth, and so then they started approving loans that should never have been approved because it was beyond what these people could afford, and then they get into trouble because of that, and then everybody says, well, then we have to bail them out, and there's something a little wrong with that whole picture. And then the other thing, I know that this whole recession isn't caused by just in someone's head. But on the other hand, they even said on the news last night that the runs on the bank, that can be because people are just panicking, just like in It's a Wonderful Life when just said, oh, I better get my money out too. And, sometimes when there's not as much need to panic because the FDIC does have it insured up to $100,000, but still everybody wants their money right then, and that can cause a bank to fail if everyone wants it right then.
Susan, thanks for the call.
I think it just goes back to people don't have really any confidence in what's happening right now in our government. I think you're absolutely right. I think Saturday, I saw in the news, some bank closed the doors because people were starting a run on the bank. So I don't know if there's any way out of this right now. To be honest with you, I think the last 8 years have been devastating for this country. We can't continue to put $1 billion a day into Iraq. And that's exactly what the Iraq war caused.
And it's all borrowed. One thing people don't realize, we're not going to a bank and taking the money
we're
out
borrowing it from
to
China.
Pay for the war in Iraq.
China,
we're selling bonds to China.
Yeah, exactly. Our biggest debtor is China, which is most people know is a leading human rights abuser. So is there a way out of this? Geez, I don't there are a lot of things I think, and there are a lot of people who give solutions. One is you can't expand, and I talk about this in my book, that military empire we're building across the world, spread all the way around the world. I mean, even the bases we have in Iraq are 30 years lifespan bases. We're going to be in Iraq for a long time. If it's true, they have swimming pools, tennis courts, shopping centers inside these bases, and they're like that around the world. The American taxpayer is funding that. And again, as Troy says, it's deficit financing.
Yeah.
There's no money there, which means inflation is going to go nuts.
And that's one reason the dollar's plummeting, and it takes so many more dollars to put gas in your tank. Because it's worth so much.
There's
less.
Just a lot of greedy people out there, to be honest with you. I don't think they care about the American people. I don't think most people in Congress care about the American people, or they would do something about this. They would be screaming. They would be telling us to get on the phones and call the president or offer us a solution. What's the solution our Congress has given us or our president?
We're talking with John
Whitehead. Offshore drilling now. So what does that mean? We don't, you know, why now? I mean, why wasn't this planned? They had to see it. You know, David Walker, who used to be the comptroller of the United States, he saw this coming years ago, and he said he kept trying to tell the Bush administration they wouldn't listen. Now he's quit. He's starting a tour across the United States to try to wake people up. Why didn't they listen to him?
And he said what?
He said the dirty little secret in Washington is we're going bankrupt. The United States government's going bankrupt. He kept telling you can't spend all this money on wars and all that, and the breakdown of the American people. He says, and you know, this goes in a little bit what I've written on what do we have an empire and democracy, but which we have evolved into an empire, and empires crumble and fall. Rome didn't learn its lesson. The British did. They backed out of their empire and kept their democracy intact. Will we do the same is the question.
You're listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now, thanks to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. If you want to get involved with the show, feel free to comment on our blog at sevillepodcast.com.
Let's continue our discussion with John Whitehead, the CEO and the founder of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org. And the phone lines are open at 977-1070. We invite you to join this conversation at any point. Just pick up your phone and give us a quick call. Charles is on the line. Charles, thank you for the call. You're on with John Whitehead. You go right ahead.
Hi, Mr. Barefoot and Mr. Whitehead. I've been listening to the program. It seems like you have this covered pretty well head to toe. I have a question for Mr. Whitehead. Have you read a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin?
Have not read that one, no.
Pick it up and read it. It's a real fascinating read. Doesn't pull any punches, doesn't gloss anything over or omit any history that really shines a great bright light on why we are where we are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Whitehead.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Charles, thank you for the call, 977-1070. Before we went to the break, you started talking about an essay you wrote recently called Empire or Democracy, Are We Ready for the Fall? And it makes me think of something Jefferson wrote somewhere when they were, and they all wrote this, basically this idea that, you know, they knew there had been free societies in the past, democratic societies that had tried this experiment, and they had all failed because they all were basically, they fell prey to powers in society that benefit from the suppression of freedom. And that all those societies in the past, these democracies, the great democracies, had fallen prey to oppression. And then they fall into revolution and reformation, and they keep going through these cycles. And it was their hope that we somehow would have the ability and the foresight and the smarts on the individual citizen level to avoid that, what they saw as could be inevitable, that history had showed them was inevitable, and they hoped, hopefully, America won't go down that path. You sort of explore that idea in this essay.
Well, first of all, they thought the education systems would be comparable to the way they were educated. And if you read what Jefferson and Madison and people like that, they wrote, they were letters to one another, but they read like the best essays and books you ever read.
Yeah.
That was what they were, great intellects. Our educational system doesn't produce those kind of people today. George Bush says he doesn't read books. That's where we're at today. Yeah, I think if we had the educational system and you know, the kind of mind thought that they had in those days, it would be much better. We don't. But there are a couple of good books out there if people want to read it. I discussed some in my new book, the Change Manifesto. But there's a book by the editor of I think Vanity Fair magazine. His name is Cullen Murphy. It's called Are We Rome? Then there's a series of books by Chalmers Johnson, if you know, a great acclaimed historian. The last one was Nemesis, and it's about how we've evolved into this worldwide empire. And it's the scenario is you can only expand so far. Your economics can only uphold so many things. And today we're in a $53 trillion hole, as David Walker says, the former comptroller of the United States, who can't finance it. But I think Murphy, in his book, Are We Rome, sets forth three scenarios. One that he thinks we may be headed toward. One is what he calls Fortress America. And that sort of looks like where we're at today, where power is concentrated in the executive, the president, and security and surveillance are the modes of today. That's basically looks like where we're at today, maybe. People, I don't know, but this is all in the book, The Change Manifesto. The president now has the power to declare martial law, and he doesn't have to tell Congress.
This is all post 9/11.
It's all post 9/11. The president of the United States has dictatorial powers now. Halliburton was awarded a $385 million contract to build detention camps in America, and they are being built. For who? Who are these camps for? They're for emergency situations. A lot of people are speculating. These are good people. These are not conspiratorial types. That if you're building these camps and it's an extended contract over time, who are these? Are they really just for some of the illegal Mexicans coming into the country? Probably not. You know, there's a lot of paranoia out there. But the point is that. And there is concern, in D.C. with what's happening, obviously. And so we may be in this kind of Fortress America kind of scenario. Then he says there's the city-state scenario where central authority breaks down, the country breaks up into various areas.
It's balkanized, yeah.
Yeah, I hear more of the talk of civil war. And there's a new book called The Big Sort by a couple authors who argue that America has already divided up into sections where people are homogenous in one area and we're no longer a diverse country. That may be happening. The last one I think was a scenario is what he calls the boardroom scenario, and that's where corporations privatize everything and government and corporations fuse, and that's commonly what we've called a fascism in the past. So yeah. Those are the three scenarios.
And all three are sort of happening now. You could make the case. They're all happening as we speak.
They're all happening right now. I mean, if you just look at George Bush's cabinet, I mean, all of them came from huge, the big corporate world. Well, Dick Cheney, Halliburton. So we're privatizing. But privatizing, as a number of authors are showing now, doesn't necessarily equate small government or less taxes. We're not seeing that.
You wrote an essay recently called Who Would Jesus Vote For?
Yes.
Who would Jesus vote for, John?
It's gotten quite a bit of traffic on Huffington Post. most of it's it's interesting to see how people respond to this. I just go through and basically say that and it's based on the fact that the 90 of the leading Christian right evangelicals just met in Denver and they've decided to endorse John McCain after they said they would not. And they're pushing to appoint conservative Mike Huckabee and a former preacher as his vice presidential candidate. I always get a little nervous when I see people voting their religion, especially Christians. As we see, they put George Bush in the White House. So, I just went back and looked at the New Testament, and what I came to the conclusion was that Jesus was the politician's nightmare, and it was the politicians who killed him during his own day. And I say he would never have run for political office, but he had quite a program, one that he couldn't have got elected on. And here's his program: love your enemies, help those who hate you, praise those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If someone punches you on the cheek, offer the other cheek. If someone steals your coat, offer him your shirt as well. If someone asks you for something, give it to him. Treat others exactly as you would wish them to be treated. Love your enemies and treat them well. If you lend money, do it without any expectation of profit. Show favor to ingrate and scoundrels. Do not sit in judgment of your fellow human being. Always forgive. What politicians could get elected on that platform? I came to the conclusion that no one. So that, I don't give the answer in the column, but I mean, Jesus fought the politicians of his time, which was basically the religious and the Roman Empire. They got rid of him. So I think any person as irritating as him and would say those kind of things and become very popular is the politician's enemy. So I think Christians that say that Jesus would have done this or that in terms of political stuff, I think he was very anti-political. That's what I'm trying to say. He saw it as irrelevant. He saw government as if there was any kind of government, it would be helping the poor. And he pushed community work and, going out and helping people. So that was the kind of government he saw as important. That is, helping your neighbor. You don't have to travel to Uganda to help somebody. Your next door neighbor's got enough problems. Why don't you go over and say, hey, how can I help? So that was what he was talking about. And like I say, he was the politician's nightmare. He was getting very popular during his time. And he was basically anti-government in that sense. And so, I mean, in those days, you get rid of irritating people, they stuck him on a cross. And people forget in that time, and at any one time, there might be 5,000 people stuck on crosses outside of Jerusalem. The Romans did a lot of crucifixions.
I didn't know that.
They got rid of radicals. Yeah, he wasn't the only one. I mean, so there were a lot of radical people they got rid of. But I just have a problem. you can't base it on the New Testament Jesus. And they're all, you know, there's a great books out there that back that up. I mean, written by credible authors who have really studied the subject. So to be honest with you, they're just plain wrong. And it's a little troubling, you know, John McCain's cozying up to the Christian right, and Barack Obama's doing a lot of Jesus talk right now. And, you know,
The irony of ironies.
There are no political saviors, ladies and gentlemen. And we just need someone competent, whether he's an atheist or she's an atheist or whatever, who can run the United States and have the American people's welfare at heart. And that's what we don't have.
We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute, and we invite you to join this conversation at 977-1070. Amanda has been waiting patiently on line two. Amanda, you're on with John. You go right ahead.
I was just listening to you guys thinking about the bumper sticker, "Who Would Jesus Bomb?" You know that bumper sticker?
Yes.
Yeah.
But the question, I always say, can you imagine Jesus with a M16 or an Uzi? It's a tough one.
And I also wanted to get back to that question I think Susan raised about, isn't the problem with the mortgage industry now that poor people were taking out loans for houses? And, you know, I thought she was sort of just blaming it on poor people that, you know, who were sort of trying to, you know, overstep their bounds and become homeowners. But, you know, it's not just the poor who are defaulting on mortgages by any means, and it seems like a big part of the problem right now, too, is that government didn't hold industry closely accountable enough over the last 5 years for their practices. So to blame the poor consumers seems really sad to me.
I agree. It's irresponsible government and irresponsible lending, and, you know, largely our leaders have become irresponsible. So you can't blame it on poor people. It's ridiculous.
It's an excellent point.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amanda. We appreciate the call. Got a phone line open at 977-1070. Go right ahead.
One thing I want to talk about, I know the hour is getting late, is I think that the Democrats are making a huge mistake. At the Democratic National Convention in late August, they built what they call cage-free speech zones of chicken wire and chain-link fence, and they're forcing anybody who wants to carry a picket sign or have free speech into these cages there.
They did it
last time in 2004, and that really hurt John Kerry because the news media picked on it and said, why doesn't Kerry, a former protester and anti-Vietnam guy, come out and say something? He didn't. They're basically adapting, you know, George Bush tactics. His presidential advance manual has all this in there where they don't want you getting close to these people and voicing your First Amendment rights to petition your government for a redress of grievances. That's all in the First Amendment. They're even going to have surveillance cameras in there watching you. But here's the kicker. They're going to put people in a cage. These are actual cages with a roof and barbed wire and all that stuff. And it's 2 football fields away with trees and sculptures obstructing your view of the delegates. Think about that for a second.
So this is at the Democratic National Convention
coming
in Colorado.
They're already being built or have been built already. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit. We're going to file a brief in the case. We are becoming really paranoid about free speech in America. We even allow this to happen in this country. Now, the Republicans, ironically enough, are not doing that. They're allowing people to basically stand across the street with their signs, and they're not putting them
in the
kit. That
is ironic.
It's totally ironic.
That's not what we're used to from the Republicans.
No, I think there's going to be a lot of fallout. So what I say in this commentary, it's coming out Monday. Barack Obama, who's a constitutional law professor, who says he believes in free speech, please come out and tell him to take those darn cages down. I almost said the wrong word.
So you can have free speech, but go down the road and get in
that
box.
But it isn't free speech if people can't hear it. You know, it's out of earshot. It's 2 football fields away. In a cage. What are they afraid of? They say, well, terrorism. Well, we studied at the Rutherford Institute. There's very little violence connected with any of these kind of events in the history of, you know. So to do that, I mean, let the police do their job. Get the police out there, have the police patrolling, have helicopters. But let these people at least, let the delegates see the signs. Let them hear what people have to say. If they disturb the peace, they can get arrested, the protesters. But
Yeah. Don't put them in a cage because they want to speak their mind.
But this is something we're seeing happen across the country, these free speech zones. We had a case where at a university, at a certain event, they told students they could stand in the alley. It was a block away from the event. How absurd to even think that this is a university in the United States. I mean, how can you think like that in America?
I got to tell you, this sounds like the kind of thing that you expect from like the old Russia when I was growing up, and it was, you know, U.S.
or what
and
they
USSR.
Do in China right now.
Yeah, or China. Yeah. Sure. Have your free speech. Go down there and get in that cage and you can speak. But Otherwise, keep your mouth shut. We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. Steve is waiting patiently online, too. Steve, you're on with John. You go right ahead.
Hey, you hit the nail right on the head when you said it's not free speech if you can't hear it. I mean, that's really it. I mean, if we don't protect the right of people to say things that we don't agree with, then, you know, we've really done ourselves a disservice.
That's the whole point of free speech.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, that is it. The other thing, I just wanted to disagree slightly with your last caller who said, oh, it's the poor consumer. Well, it's not the poor consumer that is being blamed, I think. And I think some people are saying that, but I think they're using a misnomer. It's the irresponsible home buyer, because I'm in my second house. I'm 33 years old. And certainly when we went to buy our house, you know, we were qualified by the bank for a heck of a lot more than we can afford. And people, you need to exercise some personal responsibility and judgment and realize, geez, I can't live in Dunlora on a Berkeley income.
Yeah, it's a good point. And just to, if we can, you know, put a cap on that, I think there's plenty of blame to go around. I think there's, I think Steve got a good point. I think Amanda had a good point that there's plenty of blame to go around. There are companies giving loans to people they shouldn't have given loans to, and there are people taking loans for amounts, like Steve points out, that they should never have been doing.
So agreed.
You know, when it comes to the housing, the burst of the housing bubble, I think there's plenty of blame to go around from Wall Street to Main Street.
But back, you know, back to the free speech, and he's absolutely correct. If it's not free speech, if people can't hear it, and it's free speech we disagree with, which is the most important. And it was James Madison who said the purpose of the First Amendment, and he wrote it, so he should know, is to protect the minority against the majority. And what he was saying there, it's the minority of people, the irritating ones.
The unpopular speech.
Crazy guys like Fred Phelps, the guy at Pickett's at funerals, because he thinks we're getting judged because...
To go back to your talk of Rome,
I've defended
Jesus in the street with all the homeless people.
Exactly. So that's the American spirit. I mean, when George Bush was here, they allowed some picket signs. They were too far away from my taste. But, and I will say this. If public officials are speaking and people are quiet and they have their picket signs, it should be in view of the person who's in power, the public official, or it's absolutely worthless, folks. To have the newspaper do a story about it or show pictures today or later is not it. We need to be in their faces, respectfully so, but in their faces.
John Whitehead is the CEO and the founder of the Rutherford Institute. Online at rutherford.org. John, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.